The man accused of hitting and killing a Hamilton County Sheriff's deputy with his car has been indicted as the community pays its respects for the deputy who died. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, we'll discuss this complicated case. We'll also talk about election results for Cincinnati's mayoral primary and hear the latest on a city employee who was fired after what officials called an aggressive, derogatory, and disparaging interaction with pro-Palestinian demonstrators. Joining me now to get the news review started is WVXU long-form reporter Nick Swartzel. Welcome back, Nick.
Hi, Lucy. How are you?
I'm doing okay. You are here to talk with us about this very complicated series of events. I think it's easiest to understand chronologically. Can you start by explaining what happened on May 1st in East Price Hill? I understand there was a report of a stolen car that kind of started all this.
Yeah, that day, about 9:30 in the morning, police responded to this report of a stolen car. The car had some kind of GPS tracker on it, and the owner reported it to be in this parking lot of a Price Hill apartment building off of Grand Avenue. When the police, according to police, when they arrived, four people jumped out of the car and fled in different directions. Pursuits then took place. One of the people who was fleeing was 18-year-old Ryan Hinton. And one officer says they saw Hinton with a gun. They were chasing Hinton. Another officer coming from another direction was closer to Hinton. Hinton falls. Gets back up, runs between two dumpsters, and then when he comes out the other side, as he's coming out the other side, the officer is shouting, "Gun, gun, he's got a gun." The second officer, after a couple seconds, shoots Ryan Hinton. Four rounds were discharged. The police say two hit Hinton, and aid was rendered, and he died.
What does body camera video show about whether Ryan Hinton pointed a gun at police?
The body camera footage is inconclusive on that point. It's hard to see a gun. It's really hard to see if he pointed a gun. Police Chief DG has offered some kind of supplemental evidence, the testimony of officers saying they saw the weapon, the officer who shot Hinton saying that the weapon was pointed at him. There was a moment again, when Hinton like fell, and officers said they heard the weapon hit the pavement, the sound of metal on the pavement. But the body camera footage itself, to me, and I think to a lot of other people who have seen it, is pretty inconclusive.
It was the next day, May 2nd, when Ryan Hinton's family members saw the body camera footage. What can you tell us about what happened there?
This was as you might expect, a very upsetting moment for the Hinton family. Ryan Hinton's father, Rodney Hinton Jr., apparently left because he was so upset. Like he left the room and I guess needed to take a moment. That's what we know about kind of the family's response at that moment to seeing the camera footage.
And what can you tell us about what police say Rodney Hinton Jr. did after seeing that footage?
After the footage was shown to the family took Hinton, Rodney Hinton Jr., away from the police investigations unit because they didn't want him driving. According to police, they said he was too upset to drive on his own. His car was left at the police investigations unit, and they took him around a few different places. Finley Market is what Prosecutor Connie Pillage says is one place they went. Hinton Jr. at one point took a nap, but then he came back to get his car. He left the parking lot in his car, was gone for a few minutes, came back into the parking lot, and then left again and proceeded toward Clifton.
And what happened in Clifton?
Police say that Hinton pulled up into a kind of median on Martin Luther King Jr. Drive near Burnett Woods Drive, waited there for a couple minutes, and then veered his car left into the oncoming lanes of traffic and then across the road to the spot where Deputy Larry Henderson was directing traffic for UC's commencement. Hinton Jr., according to police, then hit Henderson, killing him.
And Rodney Hinton Jr. was indicted yesterday. Walk us through those charges.
So the indictment was for two charges of aggravated murder, a charge of murder, and two charges of felonious assault. Now, those double charges are because there are different parts of the Ohio Revised Code corresponding to an officer being killed. And so there are two different charges based on the different laws on the books.
What kind of penalty could he face?
Prosecutor Connie Pillich indicated that this could be a death penalty case.
And here's what Hamilton County Prosecutor Connie Pillich had to say yesterday.
A law enforcement officer simply directing traffic was purposely targeted and killed because he was doing his job and because he was a law enforcement officer.
And here's Hamilton County Sheriff Charmaine McGuffey.
We are all mourning someone. I understand that this is a very trying time. I understand that tempers are high. What I'm asking everyone in our community to do the things that you know in your grief will help you heal. But I'm asking you to please, please let justice play out.
Nick, you were in court for Rodney Hinton Jr.'s bond hearing earlier this week. What happened there?
Judge Tyrone Yates decided not to grant Hinton bond. He listened to prosecutors and I think police saying he's a danger to himself and to the public. His Hinton's attorney, Clyde Bennett, didn't really dispute that too much. Bennett seemed to be building a sort of mental health defense, saying that both that Hinton had been under a large amount of extreme mental duress and also that he had mental health issues. So that's pretty much what happened at the bond hearing. It seemed like there was very little disagreement about whether he would get bond or not.
Okay, so tell us more about Hamilton County Sheriff's Deputy Larry Henderson. How long was he a deputy? What have you heard about the kind of person he was?
Henderson served the Hamilton County Sheriff's Office for 33 years. He was a member of numerous special teams, including SWAT, the bomb squad, and a number of other specialized roles. He was on an FBI task force. And what I've heard and seen is respect and acclaim for him as a person who just went in and did the job that needed to be done and was really well-known in the department. Also kind of on the east side of the county near Anderson, really well-known in that community. So pretty much universally from law enforcement, a well-respected deputy.
A public visitation was held for Deputy Henderson yesterday at Spring Grove Cemetery. Another visitation took place this morning at the Cintas Center. Is there a way for you to describe the support you've seen for him?
I think just an outpouring of people being there to pay their respects to him, both in terms of law enforcement agencies and the public. Folks are coming out to memorialize him.
Yeah. Now, Ryan Hinton's family held a news conference about these events earlier this week. What did they have to say about Ryan Hinton's death and Deputy Henderson's death?
One of the things I found really moving about deeply sad but moving about this situation is the way in which the Hinton family has responded, which has been with some anger and I think confusion and wanting to know more, but also especially Ryan Hinton's grandfather and Rodney Hinton Jr.'s grandfather saying, what I saw in that body camera footage was two scared people. He broke it down to like just the basic human level, like my grandson was scared, this officer was scared. And there's this level of kind of empathy and understanding saying like, you know, this is a horrible thing that happened. Let's keep focused on the fact these are human beings. Ryan Hinton's grandmother had more this, I think, anger and wanted to know more about like how this happened. And I think that is to be expected. The family has retained attorneys to do their own sort of private investigation into this shooting and to kind of like figure out how their family member died.
So, Nick, you mentioned that the family has hired a team to do its own investigation. What other kinds of investigations are happening around what happened around the police shooting of Ryan Hinton.
Yeah, Cincinnati police are doing their own internal investigation. There's also the sort of oversight, police oversight organization in the city is doing their investigation as well. I think it'll be a while before we see the results of that. Connie Pillich talked about this briefly at the indictment announcement that they don't expect to see the results of those investigations for a while.
Yeah. What's next in Rodney Hinton Jr.'s case? I understand he's being held, I think it's in Claremont County.
That's correct.
What's next with his case?
I think the thing that will come next that will be really important and interesting is his attorney, Clyde Bennett, has indicated he's going to ask for a competency sort of evaluation just to see what Rodney Hinton Jr.'s mental state is and whether he's actually competent to stand trial. I think the findings of that will be a pivotal to see what happens next in this case. Pillich, the prosecutor last night said during the indictment announcement that she hasn't seen yet any evidence of mental health issues or anything like that. But that doesn't mean that doesn't exist. That just means in this sort of initial moment that hasn't been presented.
Yeah. Did members of Ryan Hinton's family say anything about Rodney Hinton Jr.'s mental state during that news conference, or did they kind of steer clear of that?
I think briefly they mentioned he was very distressed by the body camera footage, but again, that's to be expected.
Sure. Yeah. Well, Nick, thank you so much for walking us through this very, very complicated case. I've been talking with WVXU long-form reporter Nick Swartzel. Thanks so much for your time today, Nick.
Thanks, Lucy.
Up next, we'll break down the results of Cincinnati's mayoral primary election. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Cincinnati's mayoral primary election was Tuesday. You might have missed it. A whole lot of voters did. Mayor Aftab Purval came out on top, and Republican Cory Bowman was a distant second. The two will face off in November. Joining me now to break down the results and discuss whether Vice President J.D. Vance's half-brother might have other political ambitions are Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterick. Welcome back, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
And WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Thanks for being here, Becca.
Happy to be here always, Lucy.
Well, I appreciate both of you. So, Becca, Mayor Aftab Purval was the top vote getter in Tuesday's primary election. He won by quite a bit. Tell us about that margin.
That's right. So no surprise that he won, and really no surprise at the margin either. He won with about 83% of the vote. Republican Cory Bowman, as we said, came a distant second. He had not quite 13%, just short of 13% of the vote. Now, put another way, obviously that's a big difference, but even just looking at the numbers, I think it kind of emphasizes the distance between the two candidates here. Mayor Purval with 18,500-ish votes, Cory Bowman less than 3,000.
Wow, and there was a third candidate.
That's right. Fellow Republican Brian Frank came third of the three candidates. He had just over 1,000 votes, which calculated out to about 4.5% of all the votes cast.
Chris, were you surprised by that margin? And talk about what turnout was for this election.
Yeah, I'm going to disagree a little bit with Becca. I was surprised at the margin being so lopsided, possibly because we both spend a lot of time at City Hall, and the unscientific public opinion that we see there made me think people were maybe a little bit more disgruntled with the city than they actually were. At least the voters who showed up were. I wasn't expecting the mayor to, lose or anything, not even close. But the fact that he did he basically did better than Vice President Kamala Harris against Donald Trump in the last election. I mean, this was a really, really stunningly huge victory that he had. And I was not necessarily expecting it to be this much of a margin. Turnout was awful, but it kind of always is. It was about 10%. I went back and looked at to see, what has turnout been in the other primary elections for mayor that I've covered over the last 12 years. And 2013, it was 5%. 2017, it was about 11%. And the best that I've ever covered was in 2021 when when Mayor Pureval was the clerk of courts and he was running against Councilman David Mann and State Senator Cecil Thomas and a couple of other candidates as well. And that year's turnout was about 15.6%. So certainly not the worst, but not real great either.
Well, in that 2021 election followed some pretty big news coming out of City Hall with scandals and that sort of thing. Do you think that contributed to that higher turnout?
Absolutely. And the mayor's seat was open because Mayor John Cranley could not run for a third term. So, you know, it was an unexpectedly open race. Although once Aftab Pureval got in the race, I think he immediately became the favorite that year. But, you know, you had two longtime elected officials in David Mann and Cecil Thomas who, you know, they were credible candidates. But yeah, the interest in 2021 was, you know, a little bit more, obviously, I guess a third more people were interested that year than any of the others. So,
Chris, you mentioned that you hear and observe disgruntled people at City Hall covering different news events there. What were the issues that you think Corey Bowman and Brian Frank thought could maybe work in their favor running against Mayor Pureval?
I mean, their messages were a little bit muddled, I would say. The things that they talked about on the campaign trail were the potholes that we saw. This was a particularly bad winter, obviously, and they are still not done cleaning up, you know, fixing these potholes. I can tell you the location of about 15 of them off the top of my head. So they are still struggling to get the roads, you know, into some kind of more serviceable condition. The other thing that we hear quite a bit about is connected communities and the Hyde Park Square development. People who come to City Hall and do public comment, they're very unhappy about both of those. And, you know, I thought that those, you know, might have resonated a little bit. These are the folks that vote in a mayoral primary like this, as you can see from the turnout. These are high propensity voters. These are people who are engaged, who, you know, have some awareness of what goes on at City Hall. They were apparently not as, you know, disgruntled about things as the folks that we see coming to City Hall on a regular basis.
Becca, now that Corey Bowman is advancing and will be running against Mayor Pureval in November, what does he say his campaign priorities will be?
Yeah, he kind of broke it down for a few key things. Money management is one, crime, reducing crime, and then infrastructure. So details on that, as Chris said, are a little bit fuzzy still. You know, talking about budget priorities, Bowman kind of says that the city needs to be more proactive as opposed to reactive on all of these issues. But again, especially when it comes to the budget, it is the kind of thing that it is difficult to be specific on because the budget is very complicated. And the city is going to have a much tougher time with the budget over the next several years compared to the most recent few budgets where support from federal stimulus has really eliminated the deficit that the city would have had otherwise. But, you know, Bowman is looking at kind of key basic services like, you know, like I said, crime, infrastructure, and, you know, what he says as money management, which, you know, would be kind of putting more money towards things like repaving roads and public safety.
Here's Mayor Pureval on election night.
I'm hoping that the race will turn into something more substantive, where we'll have an opportunity to really dig into my ideas and my plans, but also my opponents, because so far the race, at least for my opponents, hasn't seemed very substantive and very serious.
Becca, what does Mayor Pureval say the focus of his campaign will be?
Pureval likes to say, you know, his first, second, and third priority is public safety, and that seems to be echoed by his administration, the city manager, and you know, at least a majority of council. Now he is quick to point out, and the numbers do show this, that crime in the city is trending down. Folks might remember there was a spike in violent crime in particular, not just in Cincinnati, but across the country in the pandemic years, the early pandemic years. And Cincinnati was part of that as well. And those have been declining. Crime rates have been declining in Cincinnati since Pureval took office. And, you know, Pureval does take some credit for that. But obviously, another thing he likes to say is nobody's declaring victory, that there is still too much crime in the city, particularly gun violence, and that is a huge priority. Now, there are other issues, of course, that come up, and I think a lot of these intersect. Housing is something that this mayor and this council have focused a lot of their efforts on, a lot of attention on, and that does intersect with violent crime, I think, in particular. So I'd say those are probably the two. And then the other issue that is really going to come up for the first time, although we've been talking about it for a long time, is the railroad money, and that does have to do with paving roads and you know, really maintaining existing city-owned infrastructure. The reason that's kind of just now coming up is the city hasn't gotten any of the money from that the sale of the railroad yet, even though it happened over a year ago. You know, this will be the first budget year that the city will have what we're basically calling extra money in the budget to spend on those things.
Chris, you mentioned before that you were expecting more of these high propensity voters to perhaps vote in a way that reflected their concerns about some of these big things like connected communities, the zoning reform plan that the city passed last year that the mayor was very much in favor of, that a lot of there are a number of residents who aren't in favor of it, or the Hyde Park Square redevelopment, where there's been a lot of consternation over that. Do you think that those issues will affect the mayor in the election in November, or could it maybe affect council members more than the mayor's race?
I think that Corey Bowman, he not only is having to basically climb a political Mount Everest here, he's, you know, the results from Tuesday kind of show that he's got to climb it without shoes and maybe with like one bottle of water. Like he is in a seriously, he's a serious, you know, underdog isn't even the right word for it. I mean, it's way worse than that. So as far as the issues that we're talking about, you know, I think those are going to potentially manifest themselves more in the council races. You have a situation where, one of the incumbents is giving up her seat, Victoria Park. So there'll be a new Democrat running for that seat. We expect the charter committee to come out with its slate any time now. It could be, you know, next week. It's unclear. And so that they are attempting once again to kind of revive their political fortunes in Cincinnati and, make a stand here. So I think they're going to focus heavily on some of these development issues and basically tell the neighborhood leaders, hey, these guys have not listened to you. We are going to listen to you on housing issues and density issues. We're going to repeal connected communities, or we're going to say that we're going to do it. They're obviously not going to be able to do that unless they have six votes, which is really an outlandish probably expectation, because they're not going to run six candidates. And there were, I believe, three opponents of connected communities, including one of the council members who's leaving. So there's, you know, I think the council races are, you know, really where it's going to be at in terms of any expectation of political drama or uncertainty this fall.
Well, Chris, Democrats ran such a strong slate for those council races. I mean, it's a 100% Democratic council. Right now, do you think that's a political Mount Everest too for anybody who wants to kind of challenge that dominance right now?
I think it's less of one because you got to remember the electorate will be different in this fall than it was in the fall of 2023. The turnout in the city that year, I believe, was in the 40s. I haven't looked that up before I came on and said it, but it was much higher than we normally see because of the presence of the abortion amendment on the statewide ballot, making abortion clarifying that it is legal in the state of Ohio. And that brought out a lot of Democratic voters, a lot of left of center voters who wanted to make sure that was enshrined in the Constitution of Ohio. And so they voted yes on that. And then they probably took the Democratic slate and voted straight down it because that is their, you know, political affiliation. That is not going to be an advantage that local Democrats have this fall. So we may see some reversion, not to the mean, which, you know, prior to, you know, the 2020s, we would always have expected to see a charter committee member. We would have expected to see at least one Republican on Cincinnati City Council. The expectation that any, you know, that there are going to be either of those is very diminished, but still a potential out there because it will be a smaller electorate. It will be a less left of center electorate. And so I think that those folks you know, have some chance of getting, you know, a foothold.
Anything you want to add to that, Becca?
I was quietly nodding along to everything Chris was saying there. I tried to look up the voter turnout for that election year and couldn't easily find it. But yeah, absolutely. I think the best way to describe it is definitely an uphill battle, but much less so than this mayoral race that Bowman rather is facing. I think it will be interesting to see, you know, how much of the kind of frustration that we're seeing out of the Hyde Park Square development and a lot of those folks saying, you know, you vote now, but we vote in November. How much of that will still, you know, be felt strongly in a couple of months? I think a lot can change in local and national politics over the next several months. So, you know, I do think there is still time for other factors to enter this equation. But it would take a lot, I think, to change the characterization that, you know, Chris just described.
Well, speaking
in terms of that, Lucy, the Hyde Park situation, we should really talk about the mayor's performance in Hyde Park. I mean, in the precinct directly surrounding Hyde Park Square, you know, he got more than 70% of the vote. Like, these folks were mad as hatters. I mean, that means crazy, but they were very mad at City Hall. And, you know, they're, you know, casting a protest vote wouldn't have cost anything. I mean, the mayor was not going to not advance, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But they didn't. And the folks who were super engaged did not, you know, vote for Bowman or for Frank. And I was just a little surprised by that, by the you know, it wasn't like he just, you know, won with 51 or 52% of the vote in these precincts. He was racking up 70%. You know, Mark, you know, he had 70% of the vote in many of those precincts around Hyde Park. And so, you know, it was just kind of stunning to me. It just, the mismatch of the anecdotal anger that we hear about and the actual results from the ballots. It was just really striking to me.
Yeah. Well, Becca, Corey Bowman is best known as Vice President J.D. Vance's younger half brother. Mm-hmm. Did the vice president endorse him in this race?
He did, pretty late in the game. The vice president was pretty quiet on this race in the months leading up to the election. Several reporters had reached out to his office for comment, and he was basically just silent about it. But about halfway through the day on election day on Tuesday, Vance did tweet out, or rather post to the X, formerly known as Twitter. He said, "Hey, Cincinnati, my brother Corey Bowman is running for mayor and is on the ballot today for the primary. He's a good guy with a heart for serving his community. Get out there and vote for him." So it was a little bit of a surprise, I think, even to Corey Bowman. I asked him about it later that night, and he said he was thrilled to have that endorsement. Seemed to indicate that he's trying not to rely too heavily on that name recognition and that affiliation in this race.
Yeah. Well, here's Corey Bowman on election night.
"But when it comes to this race, we are running for Cincinnati. I need people to see that our job isn't to copy and paste what's going on in the nation. Our job is to say, however the nation's going, what's going to be best for the city of Cincinnati."
Becca, did you get the sense he was trying to kind of assure voters that he's not running on his brother's priorities, that he's a local candidate?
He definitely wants to portray himself and present himself rather as a local candidate, that he's focused on Cincinnati. He likes to say Cincinnati is the best city in the world. As our Howard Wilkinson pointed out, he is a pretty recent Cincinnatian, moved here about 5 years ago, but likes to brag on the city and really, again, present himself as someone who is focused on the local priorities. That said, I mean, he's not shy about talking about his relationship with his brother. I think, you know, he feels like that name recognition can only help him. I don't know how much it'll help in the city of Cincinnati, which, as we've been talking about, is very strongly Democratic. And he does, you know, not so much in interviews with local media on election night, but on his website, for example, does talk about some priorities that kind of hint at more national discussions, things like valuing the sanctity of life and sort of being anti-abortion access. That's something that's not really governed at the local level, not something that a Cincinnati mayor really has any control over. So these are issues that he does talk about, but I guess aren't really top of mind for him when he's campaigning.
Mm-hmm. Chris, you know, you just talked about Corey Bowman's chances of beating Mayor Pureball as trying to get to the top of Mount Everest with a water bottle and I can't remember, no shoes. I think what you said. Yeah. So that doesn't sound like great odds, but is this even about winning the race, this race, for Corey Bowman?
I don't know. I mean, the theory is out there that he's getting his name out there to build his profile for something else down the road. I understand that potentially maybe he could run for the first congressional district against Greg Landsman, but that's not Mount Everest, but that's still tough. That is a very Democratic district. And unless the Republicans in the legislature are going to redraw those lines, and still they have to put the city of Cincinnati at the center of the district. And so that just is a major, you know, handicap to any Republican running, especially one with, you know, ties to J.D. Vance, right? I mean, in another time, and you could easily see a moderate Republican in the mold of a Liz Keating or maybe an Amy Murray, you know, being competitive in that race. But a guy who's going to be associated with his brother, you know, who is a MAGA person all the way, I think that's a tough sell. But if they can, you know, again, they might change the lines, might be harder for Landsman down the road. It also could be an exercise in making the Democrats spend a lot of money in a district that looked pretty safe. But, you know, they have to spend resources on it. Maybe if Bowman runs, because of the national attention that he would draw there. But beyond that, locally, I mean, he's still a resident of the city of Cincinnati. So the politics around here, you know, are such that, you know, it's a tough road no matter what local office that he tries to run for.
Okay, well, I've been talking with Cincinnati Business Courier staff reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich and WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello. Becca's going to stay with us, but Chris, you are free to resume your Friday. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Lucy. See you later.
Take care. Up next, we'll hear about Cincinnati's new child savings accounts to help families afford college. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Cincinnati has launched a new child savings account to help families save for college. City Council is approving deals to bring new jobs to town. And a city employee is reinstated after an aggressive and derogatory and disparaging interaction with a pro-Palestinian demonstrator. We've got lots more city news to discuss, and WVXU local government reporter Becca Costello is here to tell us all about it. Thanks for sticking around, Becca.
As usual, happy to be here, Lucy.
So let's start with this employee who was reinstated. A City of Cincinnati employee was fired in October after an interaction with pro-Palestinian demonstrators. Remind us what happened during that interaction.
Yeah, so fired in October for an incident that actually happened in August. So this was after the City Council's summer session. It was kind of the one-off meeting during the summer recess. As they have been for well over a year, pro-Palestinian demonstrators had attended that council meeting to ask City Council to take a stronger stance on the conflict in Gaza. Afterwards, they had planned a kind of demonstration and a school supplies drive. Basically, they were collecting backpacks and school supplies for local children. And a local teacher who is Palestinian was standing on the steps of City Hall with a microphone. She was wearing a keffiyeh, which is that kind of recognizable traditional scarf, and was speaking about children in Gaza and kind of the conflict going on there. A man in plain clothes walked out of City Hall. This is seen on both security camera footage that WVXU reviewed and also cell phone video taken by other demonstrators. Walked down the steps of City Hall and is seen spitting in the direction of that woman three times on the ground. And then from a wider angle is seen this kind of interaction with other demonstrators there. You can see that he's kind of yelling something, shouting something. He makes a gesture with both arms kind of thrown in frustration above his head, and then makes another kind of gesture towards a young child who was there with the demonstrators.
A disciplinary hearing officer investigated this whole thing. What did the officer find and recommend?
The officer was pretty strict in the words and said this was very clearly a disrespectful and intentional gesture. Now, the employee in the disciplinary hearing at first described, and he said, oh, I spit because I had allergies and was just trying to get phlegm out of my throat, but also kind of apologized for his actions. A little bit inconsistent with the statement, said, you know, he felt like he was having a rough day and kind of snapped. And the disciplinary hearing, the officer basically said this was clearly intentional, clearly born out of frustration and a disagreement with the political views. He said the gesture toward the child in particular was violent. It did look as if he might slap the child. He did not make contact, physical contact with any of the protesters. The officer called these egregious actions, said they reflect poorly on the city, especially because it happened right in front of City Hall. These were citizens peacefully assembled, you know, exercising their First Amendment rights to public speech.
And so did this hearing officer recommend, what did he recommend?
So he recommended a 120-hour suspension. Now, the process that goes through that then goes to the employee's department chair. Mm-hmm. The department chair decided to reduce that to a recommended 80-hour suspension. That was apparently more in line with other similar disciplinary incidents over time. So the department chair recommended an 80-hour suspension. That then goes to city manager Cheryl Long, who is the kind of top boss over all city employees. And it was up to her to either, you know, agree with that recommendation or make another recommendation. She decided to terminate his employment. It was her right to do so according to administrative code. This was, was charged with violating, the good behavior kind of agreement that city employees agree to. And that can carry termination. And so that's what Cheryl Long decided to do.
Now, the employee has been reinstated, as you reported, for WVXU. Explain how that happened.
So this employee, as many, I'd say probably most city employees, is a member of the union, in this case, AFSCME. He filed a written grievance shortly after his termination, saying he believed it was an unjust termination. The first thing that triggered was a grievance hearing between the employee, union representatives, and the city's human resources department. They considered all of that. The man had asked to be reinstated to his job and receive back pay for the time that he was not working. The city's human resources department, after that hearing, declined to overturn the suspension or the termination, rather, and said, nope, we believe this was the right decision. But then it was escalated. So the employee and the union decided to escalate it to the national union. A federal level mediator was assigned to the situation. There was another hearing about that early this year in 2025. And in that mediation, the federal mediator negotiated basically a settlement agreement that the city's HR department agreed to and the union agreed to. And that resulted in him getting his job back.
How has the city manager responded to this reinstatement?
The city manager said in a statement she provided to us that she stands by her decision to fire the employee. She says she still believes that his actions are not up to the standards of city employees. She also said that, you know, as union employees, they are afforded this grievance process. It's outlined in the collective bargaining agreement. And, she obviously is sort of subject to that process. She did highlight, though, part of the settlement agreement is that they asked the employee, and he agreed to sign what they're calling a last chance agreement. It's basically saying if he has any behavior that is considered, you know, bad behavior or misconduct for the next 36 months, that he will be terminated. After that time, the settlement agreement kind of expires. He could still be terminated for future, you know, misconduct. But during these next 36 months, it's kind of an automatic termination if he does behavior that is considered misconduct.
Hmm. Has the mayor spoken about all this?
He did. And to be clear, the mayor has no authority or input even in decisions like this. But, you know, he is one of the most public officials in the city. He issued a statement to WVXU, and it's short. I'll just read it here. He says, to me, this was clearly fireable behavior. He should have been fired and should not have been reinstated. If this employee was in the mayor's office, he would not be working here anymore. I don't think this is someone who should be representing the city of Cincinnati. So pretty strong words from the mayor there.
Yeah. Have you talked to this employee who was fired and then reinstated?
We have not been able to get in touch with him. We have previously tried to reach him through the union, who declined to forward a message to him on our behalf. We also attempted the same through a spokesperson for the city manager's office. That spokesperson told me this week that the employee has communicated he's not interested in speaking to the media.
Mm. What about the woman who was at the center of this, who he kind of spit in front of.
Yeah, so I did reach back out to her. You know, we spoke to her. We are not naming her. She's asked for anonymity out of fear of being targeted. She is a Palestinian American and, as I said, a local public school teacher. She said that she is heartbroken by the decision that he's back at the city. You know, she says city employees are meant to represent all people without bias and without discrimination. She's disappointed that he's back, but also, you know, said she's disappointed that the mayor and city council have not spoken publicly in support of Gaza. You know, this is something that council did address in a resolution several months ago, but in a way that many members of the Palestinian community in Cincinnati were not satisfied with. And they have, as I said, continued to show up at city council pretty much every week during public comment to demand a stronger response. And so this teacher, you know, is expressing frustration about a kind of lack of public support. In particular, you know, she says, I'll just read a short quote from her statement. We don't need whispered empathy behind closed doors. We need public acknowledgement, visible support, and real accountability.
Let's move on to other city news. The city will be starting college savings accounts for some local children. Tell us about these accounts and how many kids we're talking about here.
Yeah, so this is a pilot program for this city, but using kind of existing infrastructure. So folks might be already aware of these Ohio 529 plans. They've existed for a long time. It's a way for parents or grandparents or friends and family to basically start saving for post-secondary education. That could be college. It could be, you know, a trade school, certificate program, that kind of thing. So what the city is doing is using that infrastructure to start a 529 account for 150 preschool age children in Cincinnati. And they're going to start that account with an initial deposit. So families who are eligible to receive one of these accounts can get up to $553 in that account over the course of the first year. But the parents will also be strongly encouraged to invest some of their own money, deposit their own money into that account. And obviously the idea is that it would grow over time with interest. It can also be invested kind of like a retirement account and grow in that way. And the idea is that over the course of 12 years or so, until that child graduates high school, then they have an account with potentially a significant amount of money to continue their education beyond high school.
And where's the money coming from?
This is money the city actually allocated a few years ago. You may have heard, I think we've talked on this program about the Financial Freedom Blueprint. There are a few other programs that are involved in that. So the council allocated the funding way back in 2023. So as far as what's going to be deposited into the account, the city is depositing $100 initially, but then Fifth Third has also come on as a partner to donate $53 as an initial deposit for each of these 150 accounts. And then the rest of the money, up to $400 from city funds, again, can be earned with sort of incentives like meeting certain benchmarks from the family, ways that kind of incentivize them growing that account and preparing for eventual further education. So that's the kind of combination of the dollars there.
Okay. And all the specifics people can find on our website at wvxu.org. Who qualifies for these accounts?
Right now, they're working with the Preschool Promise program. So this is a program for low and middle income households in Cincinnati to receive tuition assistance for enrolling preschool age children in preschool. And so they're using the same eligibility criteria since they're working through that program. And that is 300% or less of the federal poverty line. Now, that's a decision made at the federal level. So it's true across the country, which is a little bit wild to me that it's not like based on area income. Yeah. But so that I'm scrolling down here, I believe that's about in the Cincinnati area, it's about $111,000 for a family of four. So a single parent with three kids or, you know, a couple with two kids, that would be kind of the income requirement there.
And you mentioned this is part of a bigger plan to help reduce poverty in Cincinnati?
That's right. It's called the Financial Freedom Blueprint. The city initially got a grant to kind of study the wealth gap in Cincinnati and kind of identify what are the financial challenges that households in poverty, particularly households of color and Black families in Cincinnati in particular, you know, what are the barriers to increasing wealth in those families? One of those recommendations was an emphasis on on student loan debt and how much student loan debt can burden a family. But also, you know, looking at how families, how likely young people are to do some type of post-secondary education. And one of the statistics quoted in this release here is that a student who has even only $50 in a college savings account when they graduate high school is three times more likely to attend some kind of post-secondary education. So it's not even necessarily about the amount of money in the account. It can just be the fact that this has been a plan for a few years. It's about goal setting. It's about a mindset. And so that's part of the theory behind this as well.
Okay. Well, in the last couple minutes we have left, I want to ask you very quickly about job creation tax credits.
Yeah.
City Council considered a job creation tax agreement this week. Explain just briefly what those agreements do.
So it's basically a way to either bring new jobs to the city or to keep jobs that are at risk of leaving the city. And the reason that's important for the city is because they get earnings tax income from those companies and from the individuals who are paying earnings tax. And it's basically a tax credit for those companies that they can pay less to the city for a short amount of time in those income taxes in exchange for keeping the jobs here. Now, the idea is the city loses a little bit of income over the course of, you know, 5 to 10 years. But over the long run, the city is gaining much more in income as a result of this agreement. It's a tax incentive, basically a bit like a property tax agreement, but just looking at income tax instead.
I know the agreement council voted on Wednesday was for a company that had been operating in Covington. Is mm-hmm. that the goal, to get companies from other parts of the region?
You know, I talked to budget and finance director Jeff Kramerding, committee chair, rather, Jeff Kramerding, a city council member. And he said, you know, on the one hand, it's a kind of a small win. It does mean more income tax for the city of Cincinnati. But in his mind, the goal is really to bring jobs from outside the region. You know, he would prefer them to be in Cincinnati, of course, that's who he represents. But, you know, he is kind of looking at more of a regional perspective. We want to grow the economy regionally. And so, you know, ideally, it would be competing with jobs in of some of our neighboring cities like, you know, Louisville, Columbus, Indianapolis, things like that, as opposed to kind of moving jobs just locally.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like, I'll direct people to our website again, wvxu.org, but it sounds like the city's doing more of this than in the past, right?
It is, yeah. It seems like this is the fourth so far this year. We're only a few over the last couple of years. In 2024, there were none of these. So it seems like something that the city is trying to use more often as an incentive.
Okay. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WBXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.